Hi, and welcome to the Greenbridge podcast, where we are empowering tomorrow by supporting the founders of generationally disruptive companies. My name is Celia Rowland. I'm one of the analysts here, and also I have the immense pleasure of being your host throughout this quarterly series. Now, this time around, I've sat down with Emil Ephraim, the founder and CEO of Neo4j. And this is a company that you might not have heard of, but you most definitely have used their technology. So as the world's leading graph database company, you have probably used them whenever you're booking a flight ticket or potentially if you're playing around with generative AI. So listen into this very exciting and educational conversation with Emil, where he shares with us where he wants to see the company go and what some amazing breakthroughs this technology can have in the world. Okay, hi Emil, how are you today?
Hi, I'm great.
You're doing good. We've just had a little bit of a catch up about our, we both have a little bit of experience of being Swedish with American cultures and
third culture kids.
Indeed, indeed. And you now have, a third culture company as well? I've heard in one of your previous interviews you talk about being an American company with a Swedish soul.
That's right.
So today we are at your headquarters here in Malmö.
Engineering headquarters.
Yes. Do you feel like people in California get what Neo4j is quicker than maybe around here, or is, would there be a difference like that?
No, huge difference, right? Like, because specifically Silicon Valley, if I say California, obviously that includes people in Hollywood. They don't understand a new type of database better than kind of the average guy or gal. But yeah, in Silicon Valley, you throw a rock and you find 10, 15, 20 data infrastructure startups, right? And so, I mean, we'll get to it in a moment, I guess, but like on some level, when people ask me here in Sweden, right, like, what do you do? Well, what we actually do is a new type of database. But most people, if you're not in software engineering, right, you don't know what a database is. Yes, it's a term that people might throw around, but most people actually don't know what a database is. And so then if what I'm doing is a new type of database, well, first I have to explain what a database is and then a new type of database, right? So it just means that it's a little bit more distance to cover to explain what we do compared to if, again, you're in Silicon Valley and like your friends and your neighbors probably started some deep tech startups. And in fact, you might even have started one, then it's just shorter distance to cover to provide and like a good explanation of what we do.
You threw around some terms there that, again, most people in Silicon Valley will know what there is, and hopefully most people who will listen to this, but for those who don't, and I will admit it took me a little while as well, but you mentioned deep tech. As far as I've understood it, it's kind of the infrastructure of everything that we see. So if you're not in the technology world, we think of maybe applications and stuff like that, but deep tech is what's behind it, what enables all of that to be built. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like, it's on some level, you know, you can build a new type of car, right? And then maybe the innovation in the car is the seating, like the UX, the user experience of the tablet in the car and stuff like that. Or the innovation might be it's a new type of engine. So the car can drive 0 to 100 in 3 seconds rather than in 10 seconds, you know, or something like that, right? Deep tech is the engine, right? And then in the analogy, right, if you write a new application, that might be kind of the user interface in the car, you know, right. You know, that type of analogy, right? And so we're much more of the, all right, we've built a new type of engine. And that engine, a lot of people are using that engine without knowing it. And we can go into some of those use cases. But on some level, they don't know about it, right? Because it's hidden. But it's the engine that determines, hey, it's a bike or it's a car. And in our case, it's not even a car engine that we built. We built the freaking rocket ship engine, right? So it enables you to do completely new things. But at the end of the day, we're that hidden engine behind it, which honestly suits me really well. Like, if you build a consumer app company, like a Spotify or a Klarna, everyone would know who you are. We have as big or arguably bigger impact on the world, but we do it from behind the scenes. And I think that's a great spot to be in.
And then, so if we keep going with a little bit of the definitions, and this is one that I'm sure you've been asked plenty of times, what is a database for the uninitiated, and what makes a graph database so different to maybe what we used before, or what is it that makes a graph database enable all of this new technology and applications.
Yeah. So if we start kind of with a database, right? Most people know what the hardware part of storing data is in a computer. So the hardware part of storing data is called hard disks. And you plug them in, and that's ultimately where the data is stored. But there's a software component of storing data. And that software component organizes the information. It determines how to store it on the hard disk. So the database is that the software piece of storing in information. And then you can do it in different ways. So imagine if it's a library. You can sort the books in alphabetical order, or you can sort them by genre. You can sort them in alphabetical order, maybe by the author's first name or by the author's last name. So these are different ways that you can sort the books. And depending on how you've chosen to sort the books, some things become easier. If you walk into a library and it's sorted by alphabetical order, it's like, all right, give me all the books by a specific author. That's super easy. But if you walk into a library, it's sorted in alphabetical order and you want all the science fiction book or all the, you know, some genre, that's really hard. Then you have to go to all the bookshelves. So how you choose to order the books and sort the books in your library will determine what types of queries is the analogy, right? Like how you can get the information out of the library, or in this case, out of the database. So that's kind of what a database is. And before I go into specifically our type of database, if you think about that, it sounds really obscure. Mm-hmm. Like, who the hell cares? Okay, fine. Like, great. Sort that out. Yeah, store that data on your hard disks with your database. That's fine, right? But if you think about it, absolutely everything we do with our digital devices, with our phones, with our iPads, with our computers, it's centered around three things. It's about either constructing or creating information. It's about consuming information or communicating information. That's all we do with these devices. And all that information ultimately lands in a database. It's an absolutely essential part of the fabric of technology, and then increasingly the fabric of everyday society as technology is becoming increasingly diffused in the world. And so that's why the database market, switching over kind of to the business side, it's actually the biggest market in all of enterprise software. Why? Because everything we do with technology ultimately lands in a database. So that's kind of what a database is and why it matters. So our particular point of view on this is called, as you mentioned, graph database. When people hear graph in English, they sometimes think of an x-axis and a y-axis, a chart. But Mark Zuckerberg, when he talks about the social graph, what he means is all people in the world and the relationships between them. And so we've taken that concept and brought that into data. And so we say, you know what? It's really amazing if you can store information in a way where you figure out how things are connected. Because if you store them in that way, then all of a sudden patterns start emerging. You can figure out that, you know what? If I have a long list of, I don't know, employees, I can calculate their average salary, or I can, you know, count how many people have a particular title, you know, that kind of stuff. But if I start looking at them from a graph perspective, I see who is working together, who is not working together, right? Who's working on similar problems, but actually they don't seem to be cooperating. Why don't they do that? So all of a sudden, you see these emergent insights out of your data, and that has led to a completely new generation of applications and use cases that are enabled by graph databases that we just could not do before. So that's kind of the core innovation behind what we do and how we think about the world.
I've seen Neo4j in action, so I know what it looks like, and it's very much very reminiscent of the way that the human brain works, and it's those neural pathways. And what I love as well, and I think this tends to come back a lot, but it's all about relationship and finding those relationships. And that's something I think more and more people are interested in today. You and I are both wearing wearable devices. You've got your Aura, I have my Whoop. but you can find what both of these bring value to us is that it gives us patterns of our behavior. And that is only really available through something like Neo4j's technology, right?
That's spot on. And there's a lot of data technology out there that can give you kind of raw facts, right? Again, it's like, what's the average salary, right? Or how many people are called Cecilia? Mm. You know, stuff like that, right? But very few data technologies that answer the why. Why is this happening? And that's a huge part of what we actually want to get out of data and information, is understanding the why behind it all. And a lot of that ends up being about how things are connected and knock-on effects. If I change this one thing in my business or in society, what are the knock-on effects of that? And graph databases are amazing at that.
And as the world gets more and more connected, we have more and more of a need for that understanding of that why.
That's exactly right. As the world is becoming more connected and just more complex and interrelated. And you can think of this purely from a kind of running a business. And that's obviously where, you know, most commercial deployments of Neo4j are helping companies run their business better, get new insights and so on and so forth. But you also think about the climate crisis, for example, right? You think about the butterfly effect, the kind of the infamous, like a butterfly, you know, flaps its wings in Brazil or something like that, right? Like, how does that cascade across the world, right? If we understand the cause and effect, not just one hop out, but multiple hops out, I think we can just make more informed and better decisions in the world, in business, and more broadly as a society.
Yeah, and you and Neo4j is being used by a lot of large companies for exactly this reason. But let's backtrack a little bit. So let's go back to the beginning of the company. So as far as I understood it, you developed this as kind of an in-company application at first, and then you realize actually this is a lot. And if we go, we talked about a connection to California and Hollywood, but if we go into the Hollywood movie eventually about Yamele and about Neo4j, the big pivotal scene will be you sitting on an airplane sketching out on a napkin the basics of a graph database.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We were solving a problem that we had ourselves, which is there's, you know, databases were invented in the 60s and the 70s, and rapidly the industry converged on what's called an SQL database. SQL. Mm-hmm. It's a weird name, means a structured query language. And what it is a tabular database. So for those listening, you can think of this as Excel, right? So rows and columns, which is great when you have very well-structured data. When the world was very easy to understand and everything kind of looked the same, all rows have the same structure. You cannot have one row with certain columns, another row with other columns, for example, in a table, right? But when everything kind of fit that same structure, that was amazing. So then we had four decades, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, when as an industry, all software systems were backed by a database using this paradigm, using this table structure. And initially there was, you know, tens of companies who tried to do this, but over time in the late 80s and in the 90s, it consolidated down to four vendors. And they're the vendors that we all will have heard of. It's Microsoft and IBM and Oracle and stuff like that. We used that in, you know, 20 plus years ago when we, you know, at my first startup that I didn't found, but where I started work after, actually in between high school and college. And so we used that because that's what everyone was using. But we just banged our head against that wall. We didn't have data that fit really well into that. We had data that was very complex, changing all the time, deeply connected. And it kind of worked to squeeze it into these tables, but we had to do a lot of work. And the entire promise of the database is, hey, you know what? Dear developer who wants to write an application to solve a real problem, I'm going to take this entire big problem of storing the data, making it queryable, and make sure that it never gets lost. I'm going to take that off your table, no pun intended, right? So that you can focus on doing what you want to do, which is build an application. So that was the promise, but that didn't happen for us. Like, we were fighting with the database, and it took us a while to realize what kind of the root cause was. And the root cause was we started living in this world where data wasn't as simple. It wasn't as well structured. And of course, looking at it, that was 15, 20 years ago. Fast forward to today, it's not 10 times worse than back then. It's like 1,000 times worse, right? Everything is just much more chaotic, much more changing, much more complex, much more connected. But already back then, we started feeling the inklings of this. And then back to your kind of moment, then kind of famously or maybe infamously, you know, on that flight to Bombay, you know, we just sat there in deep frustration and like, there must be a better way. And we grabbed this airplane napkin and started sketching out, what if we just had nodes, which you can think of as circles, connected to other nodes through relationships. So you can think about the relationship as arrows. You know what? We can model everything. And all of a sudden, how things fit together just is there, right? And so we said, you know what? Let's just try to build this out. And that's how it started.
Right. No, and I think I assume it makes it a lot more, in a way, more human, the data, because it's the way that we naturally think. And if you put a piece of paper in front of a person and they need to organize information, that we go into kind of that brainstorming where you have circles, nodes, and then that relationship, and you draw it all together. So that's, I would assume, for a developer, it just makes it a whole lot easier to sort everything out, to move forward, and it changes things a lot.
That's spot on. For the developer, it does. Mm-hmm. And that's the most important thing. But because ultimately, at the end of the day, we serve developers. Mm-hmm. Developers are the ones that build applications. Yes, they work at big companies, but it's the developers who are the users of the database. And we enable all this innovation that they build on top of Neo4j, thanks to the power of the database. But also, and really, really powerfully, it turns out that one of the first things that you do when you're a developer and you're going to build a new system, a new application, is that you sit down with the domain experts. The application doesn't exist in a vacuum. The application is solving a problem. And if I think about this from a commercial perspective, it's solving a business problem. So what does that mean? Okay, we want to build, we're shifting to an online store to sell our wearable devices or whatever it is, right? And we want to do like some simple recommendation and upsell type thing. If other people bought this, also bought that. Okay, when the developers, they're experts at building software. They're not experts at the domain, right? So then you get so-called domain experts in there. It's like, okay, how should we think about this? And the domain in this case is retail and recommendations, but it might be pensions or like insurance or like whatever that is, right? And the first session is typically you get these domain experts into the room, and then you start whiteboarding. And the developers start picking their brains and like understanding what's actually going on so that they can then express that in software. One of the earliest, like most magical things that we saw was that initial whiteboarding sessions, because initially we were the developers building on top of our database, right? Those initial whiteboarding sessions with the domain experts, when we took the photos from that and we compared that to what actually ended up in the database, it was a one-to-one mapping. Because those domain experts, they rarely started drawing tables. They said that, what was my example, like a shopping cart. Like there's a shopping cart in that, you put order items. Those order items, you know, are of products. Those products sit in a product hierarchy. Every single shopping cart is owned by a customer. A customer belongs to a segment. That's the kind of stuff that they started whiteboarding, right? Mm-hmm. So it's all about concepts that are connected to other concepts. It was just this magical thing where we looked at the database and we could see this one-to-one mapping with the whiteboard. We call this whiteboard friendly. What's on the whiteboard is reflected in the database. What that means is really, really powerful. That means that all of a sudden, the developers at that enterprise is speaking the same language as the business. And that is this classical divide between what people are out there actually doing stuff in the line of business, what the developers build. There's typically this huge kind of divide between the two, right? And that's one of the most powerful things that the graph database enables, the fact that they can now speak the same language.
One of my thoughts was, I can understand when you're, for example, in the beginning stages, when you were trying to convince people of the efficiency. I assume you didn't have to do that much convincing, but for example, for a developer who works with this, they can very quickly grasp the benefits of what it does. But for example, for someone who is not in the engineering team, how would you go about, especially in the early days, how did you go about that? And would it be kind of, okay, this is linked to efficiency because the graph database is a whole lot quicker to retrieve information from than other databases?
Yeah, that was a tricky one. Mm. To be honest, it still is, right? Because again, it's like the primary stakeholders are the developers. The best way we have kind of figured out how to do this is show and tell. Mm. Sorry, show, not tell. In other words, I can talk all the talk I want, but if you can visually show the impact, right? If you say, you know what, and this has happened so many times to me, right? I get in there with our team and I get a little bit of the data of that organization. And all of a sudden I show them that, you know what? Here's a bunch of fraud that you couldn't see before because you couldn't see the connections between these individual transactions. It's actually forming a fraud ring. That is 3-5% of the fraud of your entire enterprise. And you are some big bank that might have billions of dollars of transactions times 3-5%. The look in their eyes, like the simultaneous excitement and blood, like whatever, and excited, and they're scared at the same time, right? That's the show not to tell kind of meaningful moment that I think has been the most powerful way to convey that to non-developers.
Mm. one of the, I guess for you, major show, not tell, of how to use Neo was the Panama Papers that came out, where through your technology, through your database, you could find that hidden relationship that otherwise would have been incredibly hard and would have taken a lot of time to even get close to figuring out some of that. How was that for you to see it in action, but also have there been any other use cases that you can think of that have been just as pivotal or maybe more for you?
Yeah, it was amazing when it happened. And it's a great example of, I guess, the engine analogy that we did before, which is, you know, we build this amazing engine. Through that, people can build great vehicles, right? Again, the vehicle is what solves the problem. But if you have a bike engine, you can build a bike. If you have a car engine, you can build a car. And with Neo4j, you get a rocket ship engine. Yeah. But that's a great theory. What that, the way that manifests is in a myriad of different applications, many of whom we could not even foresee when we sat down and we invented the thing, right? This is a great example of that where, holy crap, this is the biggest investigative journalism of all time. 200 organizations, journalistic organizations or media organizations across the world looking into the biggest leak in journalistic history. And it got all kinds of impact, right, in terms of prime ministers having to resign and so on. So when it happened, it was just exceptional to see the impact. It was also like well-known in popular culture. It's 7 years ago today, so most people have probably forgotten it. But it was the biggest news story for the first half of 2016. Then Brexit happened, and then Trump happened. So there's a lot of things that happened in 2016. But for the first half, and then subsequently it went on to win a Pulitzer Prize. And so it also gave us this example where we could point to something that most people understood and could say that this is what we enable. The closest, and I guess your question was, has it been anything as pivotal? We have several things that are very tangible that affect people's lives. So for the people listening, I think probably everyone listening to this have been on a flight before, or at least regularly, you know, probably regularly flying. So 99% of all flight tickets, the price is calculated with Neo4j. And why? Because the price of a ticket is very much dependent on how you get from point A to point B. And sometimes there are direct flights, but here we are recording this in Malmo, Sweden, right? And I was just last week in Orlando in Florida. There's not a direct flight from Copenhagen Airport to Orlando. So I have to connect through Amsterdam or through London or through JFK. So those are all different paths. And what path I choose is going to be a big driver of what price I get. So you can see how that's a great use case for Neo4j. So 99% of all flight tickets in the world are calculated with Neo4j. So clearly, every single person who's listening to this podcast has used Neo4j, but indirectly. And the same is like sticking with travel as an example. Marriott is the biggest hotel chain in the world. They obviously own Marriott, like the brand, but a bunch of others like Starwood Hotels and Ritz-Carlton and so on and so forth. All those rooms, the prices are calculated with Neo4j, right? So those are great examples. Honestly, probably the closest we get to the Panama Papers is what's happening right now with the world of generative AI, large language models, and the perfect marriage that that has with what's called knowledge graph. And I'll maybe pause right there because this is opening up an entire new can of worms, which, you know, we could spend hours talking about. But I think that is the closest we've seen to the Panama Papers in terms of just worldwide recognition of the power of graphs.
No, and AI was one thing that I did want to pick your brains on today, because one of the issues that we have with AI is this hallucination. And we don't know really why it does that, but by using a graph database, which most AI today does not, you can correct that. And you can also see the trail behind why it is hopefully not hallucinating, but if it's coming up with an answer, you can see the kind of the paper trail as to why it would draw that conclusion. In the same way as when you ask a person, oh, why did you think of that? You can go, well, because of this and this and this. So where would you like to implement Neo4j into that world, and how can we solve it?
You're spot on, by the way. That's exactly what it does, which is these LLMs are magical. LLM is large language models. So that's the technology backing ChatGPT. And they're freaking magical. I think we've all been blown away what they can do. We've been equally disappointed, probably on random things where it falls short, right? But magical powers in so many ways, right? But like an example that I use is in the early days when ChatGPT came around, I started playing around with it, of course, very early. And after a while, my wife started playing around with it too. And she asked ChatGPT, who is Emily Ephraim married to? And it said, Emily Ephraim got married in 2011 to Johanna Ephraim. My wife's name is Madeline, right? Johanna Ephraim is my cousin, my second right. cousin, actually. And I did get married in 2011, but not to my cousin. You know, I can guarantee yes. that, right? And I have no idea why it just made that up, right? Because Johanna Ephraim was somewhere on the internet. And, you know, then it just happily didn't know the answer. So it just auto-completed and said that, but with a high degree of confidence, right? And, you know, coming back to my relationship to Greenbridge and to Ola. Ola, of course, famously was the CEO of Hexagon for about a billion years or something like that, right? You know, and so if you ask ChatGPT about Ola, I actually haven't done that, but you could see it saying Ola is the CEO of Hexagon, yeah. right? Because maybe it's updated, maybe not, right? But if you have a knowledge graph, if you've expressed your organization's knowledge in graph form, you can see that, hey, you know what? Ola actually is at Greenbridge. Ola is an investor in Neo4j. Greenbridge actually is an investor in Neo4j, right? You know, that type of thing, right? Ola is on the board of Neo4j, right? You know, that kind of a thing, right? Mm. And if you've expressed that in your knowledge graph, and you can then marry that up with the answer that you get from the large language model, and all of a sudden you can express facts, and you can express your organization's point of view in the large language model. So that's a really powerful thing that the marriage of large language models and knowledge graphs gives you. But then exactly to your point, it also gives you explainability. And that's a big freaking deal. Because as bad as it is that the LLM sometimes hallucinates, and I say sometimes because sometimes that's bad, many times that's bad, it's also its superpower. Because the flip side of hallucination is creativity. And sometimes we want it to make stuff up because that is what creativity is. But in the use cases where we don't want it to make stuff up, the fact that we can marry it up with a knowledge graph to provide facts and accuracy is huge. But equally important, I would say, is this explainability piece. And the LLM is a black box. You ask it a question, it gives you an answer, you have no idea why. And it's deeper than that, actually. It's not just that you as an end user don't know why. Even OpenAI, the people who build ChatGPT, they don't know why. If you train your own LLM, which if you're a machine learning engineer, you can do, it's actually really hard. It costs millions of dollars, if not tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. Even if you've built it, you can't explain why it's giving the answers that it does. If you marry that up with a knowledge graph, all of a sudden you see that, you know what? I said that Ola is an investor in Neo4j. Why? Because Ola works at Greenbridge and Greenbridge is an investor in Neo4j. You get that explanation. Mm. And what that explanation does, it gives you an audit trail, which is huge in many industries. Like anyone in banking or insurance or anything, anytime you make any kind of decision based on this, being able to explain it might be not a nice to have, but an absolute requirement in a regulated industry. It also, I fundamentally believe that we need to have a human in the loop for most, if not all, real kind of Gen AI applications, at the very least to have an accountable human for every decision, right, that is being made. Otherwise, we get into very weird kind of legally murky and morally murky land. So having a human accountable for every decision is really crucial. Most humans don't want to be accountable for a decision that they don't understand. But if you can explain it all of a sudden, then you can have an accountable human in the loop. So that becomes really important, even from an AI regulation and AI policy perspective. So those are the two big things that knowledge graphs add to the world of LLMs: increased accuracy in the fact that we can have facts that reduce or eliminate hallucination, and it gives explainability to large language models.
For me right now, AI is, it's fantastic, but it's a little bit got this gimmick about it still, at least in the everyday user interaction. But there are cases of using it also for something great, like for example, I believe it's Microsoft came out with that they have found the sodium battery that you can use instead of lithium, which comes back to your point of saving the planet and moving forward in that way. But we can only use AI for that, and I would assume there's some sort of graph database behind that one as well, but we can only really use it to its full potential while there is this accountability, there is this also context of where it's being used. So using a graph database to move AI from where it is to actually helping and moving the world forward a little bit more. I think that switch will really come from using Neo4j.
That's exactly spot on. And if I take it away from the broader impact of AI and generative AI on the world into my world as CEO of Neo4j, I think most Gen AI applications over time will use a combination of LLMs and graphs. And actually, industry analysts like Gartner are saying that they are really bullish. They believe already in the next couple of years, more than 50% of all LLM-backed applications will also use knowledge graphs. So that's just exceptional in terms of adoption of our technology. As the leading graph database, you know, coming back to, I guess, where we started, going full circle, the flight to Bombay, and you know, we're the creator of the category of graph databases. We're the leader in graph databases. If over 50% of all applications of large language models also use a knowledge graph, that's just an absolutely amazing opportunity for Neo4j.
So coming into it a little bit for you, where would you like to see, like, what's a personal desired use case for you with it? Where would you like Neo4j to go?
Yeah, so that's a big question. Yes. Lots to unpack in that one. I think we have an opportunity to build a truly generational company. We have this really unique point of view on data that is very differentiated, and it's very, very valuable, which is exactly what you said at the beginning there, which is relationships at the core and center of understanding data and making sense of data. That, I believe, can be this absolute pillar of the entire data landscape. So over time, I think we can build one of the leading new modern database companies, if not the leading new modern data company. And that is a tens of billions of dollars of revenue opportunity. So that's kind of my kind of CEO hat on it. Let's call it that. If I take on my founder hat, I want all that, but I also want more, which is the impact that that will have on the world. And this is, you know, we've touched on this a lot in this conversation. There's a huge amount of value in understanding the core reasoning behind the why behind in data. And I've talked about this before. There are now 20 independent projects using Neo4j to find the cure for cancer, wow, which is obviously just a terrible, terrible disease that is most likely affecting either directly, sadly, or indirectly, one or two hops out, every single person listening to this podcast. You know, I'll make it personal on my side. I, you know, we touched on this before we started recording. I was an exchange student for a year in the U.S. as a teenager, and so I have an adopted American family. I'd call them mom and dad, and I had two brothers, one an older brother and a younger brother when I lived there. Was the best man at my little brother's wedding, and you know, so very, very close. But my older brother died from cancer when he was 24 years old. So had a big tumor in his forehead, size of an egg. There's a real chance. Is it 5%? Is it 10%? Is it 30? Like I can't handicap the probability, but there's a real chance that Neo4j can play a meaningful role in finding the cure for one or more types of cancer. And so when I put it all together, what am I looking for? Where do I want this to go? It's build a truly generational company that is a leader, if not the leader, in the modern data world, tens of billions of dollars of revenue, but that also has led to the type of impact where it's been a meaningful part of identifying a cure or two cures or three cures for different types of cancer. If that happens, I'm going to say, all right, it ended up in a good place after all.
Yeah. Before we finish off, and thank you so much for your time. It's been amazing to hear. And it's definitely, I think, for anyone listening to it, will have much more of an understanding of just what value Neo brings to the world and where we can go. Anything that you're looking forward to in the next year or two that you would like to finish off on?
I'm just really excited about the next couple of years for kind of, I think, the industry generally speaking, Neo4j specifically, but I think as an industry, we've gone through, honestly, like a tough time. We had the ZIRP era, right? Like a decade of zero interest rates, basically. And, you know, people talked about kind of growth at all costs. And it's been a sharp left turn for many people in the technology sector, right? Where all of a sudden it's back to kind of fundamentals. And honestly, Ola talks about this a lot, right? That, like it's not just growth, like you also have to do that in an efficient way, right? So it's how much you spend to get that growth. And in many ways, kind of the world of technology has now caught up to what Ola's been saying for a while, right? And that has been tough for many people. We've also kind of, the recession has seen certainly companies pull back on spend, right? Which makes it harder to sell and any software and kind of any product. So it's been a tough couple of years, I think, for the industry. But clearly, I think that it's a really healthy thing. And if we look, again, taking more of a decades view than a quarter to quarter type view, most amazing companies, probably not all, but most amazing companies were born in these types of times. We certainly were born just at the end of the great financial crisis, right? I was out fundraising then. I was building the commercial part of the company, the first customers. That all happened in 2008, 2009, 2010, right? Those are very different from the 2019, 2020, kind of 2021 times. So I think that's really, really healthy. And I think the next couple of years, the truly strong companies are going to emerge as much, much stronger out of this. For Neo4j specifically, the advent of AI, it is going to be a game changer for us. We already see it in our business today, how excited people are to adopt Gen AI into their applications and marry that up with knowledge graphs. And so when I add this up all up together, I think the next few years are going to be absolutely amazing and exciting and thrilling and tough, and it's always a roller coaster, but I'm really excited about them.
All very, very exciting. And again, thank you so much for your time today. It's been great. Thank you so much, Emil, and catch you next time.
Thanks, Cecilia.